March 1944 found us wondering when the day was. On April 6th I went on leave and last one for a long time. On April 14th we left billets and went out on manoeuvres, living in the open. At the beginning of May we went into a canvas concentration camp and started waterproofing for D-Day. We made one false start to keep Jerry guessing and came back. Then came the briefing. We were shown maps with all the names in code, and learnt the roads we were to use, where the minefields were, and first objective. Aerial photos taken of our beach showed curtains at the windows and mined sea obstacles, photos taken only a week before. Still, we didn't know where we were going. They wouldn't ever admit it was France. On Saturday, June 3rd, we went to Southampton and waited in the street for our turn to load. A jeep mounting a loaded Browning patrolled up and down to make sure we did not speak to civilians. We loaded about 3 p.m. and stood out in Southampton water. On Monday, we joined other formations of craft, and in the evening, we were wallowing our way across the channel. Before it got dark, we saw the whole sea alive with ships, cruisers, destroyers, etc., keeping watchful eye on the big brood of landing craft, slopping along on their flat bellies at 8 knots. We went to sleep by the guns that night, knowing we were landing on the Cherbourg Peninsula near a little town called Arromanches, more accurately, the village of La Rivière. At dawn, June 6, I looked for our companion ships and they were still there, ploughing along with us. Just before we started firing, a dark cloud on the horizon gradually became land, France. Then we started, fire by order, 4 rounds, gun, fire, fire. I opened the breech and rammed shells till the sweat ran off. Every time the gun alongside me fired, I felt the flame on my face until I got so dizzy I didn't know when my own gun fired. I had to watch it slide back to be sure. Two of the guns behind, firing over my head, didn't help. Everything was letting loose all it had, and big black clouds of smoke gnarled across the ground behind the beach. The infantry boats were rolling and pitching horribly, going right out of sight for half a minute at a time. As we got nearer, the rocket ships went off with a peculiar noise that made me jump, and houses collapsed in piles of rubble. Overhead, our planes swept back and forth with no opposition. Two big spouts went up to our left. Enemy shells. Phew. As we nosed into land, I went to the lowered ramp and watched the obstacles. I was first tank off and didn't want to bump a mine. The tide was coming in fast and the obstacles were disappearing. We were drifting too, so that when we grated ashore of ground, I couldn't see a thing. There were about 50 yards of water to wade through before we got onto the beach, and also mines, but as luck would have it, we never hit one. Turn off on the beach and look for the troop leader. Okay. I ran down the beach with the tank behind and found out when I was to go into action. I faintly remember bodies of prisoners and a man in a tight-fitting rubber suit. These were frogmen who had been diving for mines. The beach by this time was no wider than 30 feet. As I swung right onto the line of fire, the extra ammo container I was towing fouled the tracks, so I had to cut it adrift. Two officers shouted at me to move the tank as I was blocking the track. I told them to go to see the GPO. After one target, we moved. I tried to pull out a Sherman stuck in the sea, but the rope broke. I had to leave him. The beach exit was blocked and bulldozers were working on it. While I waited, a landing craft drifted onto me and ground a big dent in the tool locker. Then it drifted away, only to crash back again, trying to lift the gun out of its socket with its ramp. I went mad winding the gun up and down, trying to save the gun. Somebody shouted to me to be careful if I backed because there were two mines behind the track. They were like two beer bottles wired to a big log, and as I jumped down to have a look, an officer gave me some wire cutters and said, "Cut them clear, you get the MM. I don't know what made me do it, but I handed them back to him and said, "You, Cousin Claire, you'll get the MC." He tried, but he couldn't. So I decided to risk the tank, turning in time to miss them. Meanwhile, the craft was banging away at the front. The only man left on the tank was a wireless operator. The rest had dismounted. The WO was scared of mines, but we could drive. So, back right stick. We missed the mines by inches and then off up the road to join the rest. They were in action by a troop of four German guns in concrete emplacements. The guns were undamaged but deserted. Where the gunners were, I'll say later. The end of D-Day found us quite a few miles in. The woods were full of snipers. For the next few days, they came out in hundreds, persuaded by flamethrowers. The first time the wireless operator got off the tank was at the end of D-Day, and he jumped straight onto a metal disc 6 inches wide, which I'd thrown down. His face was a study. He looked up and said, "A mine!" but didn't try to get off. Poor old Jeff was always in trouble. So we started off in France, the luckiest men alive. Afterwards, we were told something about the beach we didn't know. An 88mm gun was still firing 4 hours after we had passed. Spandaus were still manned, and the gunners, of the four big guns, were in dugouts 20 feet below for hours after we left. Every night, Jerry planes plastered the beaches, but we were safely inland by that time. It was a long while after when we had a first bombing about 7 weeks after D-Day. The war was very pleasant then. Lovely weather to camp out in and no rubbish coming back at us. We enjoyed it for weeks until in the fighting for Tilly we had to fire big fire plans and lump ammo all day.